And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Anthony Michels about the economic system, about the usury, about some of the issues that are seldomly addressed within the problems of the economic system. And of course, we're going to get a little bit deeper into what some of the things are that we can actually do about this, what would be viable as a alternative method when it comes to currencies and the economic system. And there's just a lot to talk about, really, a lot of things that has occurred in the last few years as well, in terms of how the economic system has been reformed. And I still feel very much that we're stuck within this kind of dialect, as we saw, for example, the market crash of 2007-2008, that we had, of course. And I've always maintained this, that they seek to, you know, basically centralize wealth and put it in fewer hands, basically. And that's definitely something that we saw during that time. And of course, an immediate response to this has been gained, you know, leverage on the from the Marxist point of view as well, that we need to move towards a yet another version of this where we have more control about it. But what's your view on the market crash? And it seems to me, Anthony, that if we look at this historically, this is how they've run things for a very long time. They crash the market, they buy up things that other people are forced to sell, the monetary system. A lot of banks and insurance companies, of course, went out of business, but that the wealth from that, the control of those assets, of course, ended up in someone else's hand. Was this the plan, do you think?
Oh, absolutely, Henrik. There can be zero doubt about that, because the boom-bust cycle is a completely artificial phenomenon, which is created in the simplest of ways. First, the banks start lending, as a result of which, because the credit they provide inflates the money supply, because it's just new money that is being brought into circulation. And then you have rising prices as a result of this inflation. And then at some point, the banker will just say, well, we're going to stop lending. And they will have this excuse. They will cite lack of confidence or need for structural adjustments or what have you. Doesn't matter what. They always have a story. Every boom and bust has a different story. But it's always just hot air. It has absolutely nothing to do with the essentials, which is that the banks created first by lending and then by deflating the bubble. And they have been up to this for literally centuries, many centuries by now. In Amsterdam, there was at the time in 1634 an infamous tulip bubble. Everybody has heard about it. This was also created in the same way, and they've been doing the same thing forever under gold as much as under credit-based units. Let that also be very clear. The whole idea that bankers cannot create asset bubbles where the gold standard is just so completely ridiculous. If you have any historical awareness at all, if you, your historical awareness precedes the Second World War, which is, I think, very important to develop, because we really need to start looking at history in a far more longer term way, which is, I think, actually an important point, because
I agree. Yeah.
People think, oh, it's centuries ago, it is very long ago. No, no, no. 300 years ago is not long ago. And the events of these days still very much work on today in a very visible ways. And even things that happened literally 2,000 years ago have a very clear impact on us today and clearly forms and shapes our current reality. And we can only understand our current reality if we take a broad view of history and also start seeing the big trends. Because if you look at decades, you don't see the big trends that work out over centuries. That's, I think, the main issue.
Well, exactly. I mean, you're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. The historical effects are like ripples on the surface, and these crash into each other. I think jokingly, someone's asked another person, what do you think about the French Revolution? And he said, it's too early to tell, you know, because these things are, you know, playing out on a long-term scale. And I think this is also one of the reasons why we today, primarily in the West, are so backwards, and we don't understand what is being done to us, how we're being, you know, used and manipulated, because we are absolutely 100% obstructed by the nonsense of, you know, pop culture and celebrities and all this junk that we you know, analyze and need to analyze, of course, of what influences people on this program. We talk about that on the show, of what influences people. But nonetheless, what do you think we can do to make people get into that mindset of like realizing that history is key here? This is where you open up not only to the interest of what is good to yourself and your own people, and recognize the struggles that they've went through, so that you feel veneration even for, you know, your past and your country and the people that was there, etc. Because without this, I feel that we are like rag dolls. We can just be thrown around. We're absolutely controlled, and we don't see this long-term cycle as I think our detractors do.
Absolutely. I think it's a vital point, and not knowing your history makes you completely controllable, and that is undoubtedly a huge part of our predicament. And in my own work on real currencies, I, you know, it's just unavoidable that you hit on long-term historic trends. And I discuss things happen. Yeah, well, okay, my scope on the website has been maybe 500 years up to now, but I intend to go even way back further than that, because yeah, like I said, these trends actually work out over thousands of years, and we really need to open up to these things. And we've been blinded by this idea that 100 years ago is a long time. It is not. It's yesterday, you know. The people are alive that were born 100 years ago. They can actually tell what happened back then. So it's not long ago. It's very much part of where we are, and we need to have a good view of our history. And yeah, well, you know, about reaching people, I have a very clear perspective on this. People that are going to be reached, we will reach, and a great deal of people will never be reached. And what I will expect to see happening in the coming years, because I think that we are at a very vital turning point in history, is that we will see a growing divide between the people who want to, you know, keep busy with celeb news and consumerism and what have you, and the people that that are getting more and more disgusted with our unnatural way of living, our completely sex obsessed way of living, consumerist, superficial, and of course, all the while seeing our natural heritage being plundered and being robbed from us, because we are being herded into complete slavery, and it is already almost complete. And I do want to make a little link back to your previous question about the crunch, because that is really it's really a very vital part of that story, because this crunch has been created with a very clear intent of destroying the West.
Yeah.
But no doubt about that. That's the key target of the crunch is the United States. People talk about these days about the end of the New World Order, because they see the end of the American Empire coming. But the New World Order is alive and well. It's just their vehicle, the American Empire, that they are decapitating. And this crunch will see the destruction of the United States economic supremacy, which is already non-existent, because, you know, you hear stories about 17 trillion GDP in the United States. It's all complete bollocks. If it's half, it's a lot. And China has already for a long time taken over
surpassed.
The United States.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think I saw the news yesterday or something like that. But I suspect that's been going for a long time. What's interesting about that, though, is, of course, that China is absolutely at this stage dependent on all the junk it produces for the United States and its people to buy it. So it is, I guess, to a certain extent, a kind of a deadlock. And allegedly they were buying, you know, some of the debt for a while and things like that. But where do you think that the power shift is going, and why is that? Why do you think the determination was made that, you know, when the globalists said, all right, let's, you know, shift to Asia primarily and let's put this kind of the power center there for now? Is that just because it's practical? Is just what they do? Is there other reasons for it, do you think?
Well, I think that the most fundamental reason is that, and this may be a little bit controversial, but the races have different strengths. And the key gift that the Western civilization has to offer to the world, as I see it, is that that we in the West have a real respect for the individual, and that is a key component of our culture and of our philosophical mindset. And Asian people, they have a very high IQ, maybe even higher than Western people, but they have a collectivist outlook on life.
Sure. Yeah.
And this is much more in line with what the New World Order has in mind for us all, obviously, in a collectivist world government. And I think that they are moving on to China, because China has been completely, you know, if you look at how people live in China, what they have been through with after the emperors were subverted, say, mm-hmm. in the 20th century, especially by Mao, who was a skull and bones man, and of course a Marxist. And everywhere you see Marxism, you know who's in charge. And China has been going through the Cultural Revolution, and it's a demoralized people. They have been able to inflict on them a one-child policy, which is obviously utterly ghoulish and incredibly cruel, and also completely unjust, because obviously the wealthy and powerful will have had more children than one. But and it has created huge problems also for China's future, because they're facing there also a huge how do you call this? Population collapse. In the
Right.
decades ahead, they will see a declining population and a graying population, which with all the associated problems of these. And I think they can control China. They do control China, because obviously, let's make this very clear, they have outsourced their entire manufacturing base from the United States to China, and obviously they would have never done this if they were not absolutely completely 100% sure that they would be able to control these factories there too. And so China is well on board in the New World Order, and America is actually still a bit of a threat, because they have an armed population. It's a very powerful country because of its natural location, a huge population also, and the American Empire was a bit of a competitor for the banker empire. And first they used it and made it big, and now they're making it small now that it has served its purpose. And its purpose basically was to export globalism.
I think you're right. I mean, I think of course, what's interesting here is that the West has been used, as you say, to build up the infrastructure of the next control system, and the machinery that is run by the elite empire has been done with the ingenuity of the West. And of course, now I think the West is kind of a liability for them. They want a little bit too much. They're too uneasy with, as you said, collectivism. They're doesn't like where they see the development going. And of course, China will. And India and some of the other countries as well will be a superpower that's been built not only with the aid of the elite, of course, because this is where they transfer their power, but really by American and Western European technology and skill, right? And now they're just selling out their own people, you know?
Yeah, totally. And then it has something to do with the fact that we're not their people, you know. They're all only beholden to money and power. They're totally cosmopolitan. And also,
Yet we take the blame for their actions, right?
well, this is the white guilt issue, of course, that you are now referring to, and this is just such bullshit, and we really need to get that out of our system, Henrik, and
Yeah, I
all
know.
this bullshit about slavery. And look, we have made mistakes. I mean, many white people will tell you that this capitalism is really grand, and that Africa should not be complaining because they have been independent for 50 years. Well, no, they have not. They have been plundered for 50 years to an unbelievable extent. So there is, you know, people associating themselves with capitalism, they really should disassociate themselves from it. But it is not white guilt, it is capitalist guilt.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. And the view, I think if we look at it historically, wasn't like that. We have a view today that is defined by these new progressivist politically correct ideals, where actually they're more obsessed with race today than I think they were in the past. They didn't view it that way. I mean, they enslaved the Irish and the Scots, and they enslaved the Slavs, whoever they could. It didn't matter, you know. They enslaved their own populations against them. But today, it's kind of a race lens that people use to look at this and think that it was according to those lines, when it wasn't like that. Clearly, when you look at it, they viewed, I guess, more internally about class and social status and things like this than anything else, right?
Absolutely. If you look at the fate of the British common man that we were just discussing in the 19th century, while Britain was so-called ruling the waves, the fate of the British common man was just deplorable. Absolutely, totally enslaved in the sweatshops, and really lost generation upon lost generation in these sweatshops. So, you know, the whites have suffered from capitalism immensely, and they still do, because let's face it, most of our income is being robbed through usury, which is the core of capitalism, because capitalism without usury is unthinkable. Capitalism rose together with usury after the usury prohibition of the medieval era ended. And basically, capitalism is just a market economy with banking, and banking just sucks everything up. So, capitalism is everybody's enemy, and the whites as much as all the other nations and races of the world. And we should basically unite against the banks and their new world order, because the new world order is nothing but banking gone global. And this whole race issue, and then you say, okay, everything is looked through a racial lens. But obviously, as a white person, you're absolutely not allowed to look through a racial lens,
No,
and
no.
racial pride, or just respect for your own heritage, for your own forebears, etc. This is all completely forbidden, and it's a bloody disgrace. And the whites have every reason to claim ownership of their own lands and resist mass immigration, which is total rape. Mass immigration has nothing, has never been anything else but an endgame scenario. It is always combined with societal collapse, with the end of empire, with end times. And just look at what the Palestinians are enduring from Jewish mass immigration. Just look what the natives endured from Western immigration. So no, mass immigration and racial consciousness is being it's an attack. It's a Marxist attack.
Yeah, it is exactly. I'm glad you mentioned that. It definitely is. If we look at the various empires again, historically, as I said, the importation of different peoples, and of course, this in some cases came through slavery, came through other means, what have you. But it's always resulted in chaos and destruction. And of course, if this is the plan, then these are criminal activities. And I think that a lot of people would react if there was if this was done in any other capacity, if Asia was invaded and the plan was population replacement, quite openly, as the elite has been talking about now when it comes to Europe. But if we would reverse the situation, I mention this often, but we have to bring it up, folks. It's just what we have to do, and keep pushing on the double standards of what is occurring here, and the very aspect that we as a majority in Europe, in our own lands, well, we're not a global majority, but we're minority globally, but we're majority in our own lands. We do not have the same rights even as other people are that they're coming in, and this is done for destructive purposes, and this should be viewed as a criminal act. It should be viewed as genocide, because that is what it is,
It is. It is absolutely just that, Henrik. Let's absolutely not mince words about these issues. It is genocide. The intent is genocide. Its effect is genocide. And immigrants, I really want to say to immigrants, it's not about you immigrants. It is about you being pawns, immigrants being pawns in the hands of the globalists. And the immigrants, I interact with a lot of immigrants here in Holland, because obviously there are plenty here also. And in many respects, I feel I feel much closer to immigrants than I feel to the billionaires that run this asylum here. It is not about the immigrants, but the immigrants do share in this cultural Marxist tendency to call people racist, to resist mass immigration. And I really wish for immigrants to stop doing so, and stop attacking white people for feeling real disconcertment, and very rightfully so, with this huge influx of immigrants, which anybody must be able to realize, if he has some basic human empathy, must be very bad for our nations. And here we have a lot of Moroccans and Turks, and I always make the case. Listen, you in Morocco, if you open up the border and allow 5 million black Melanese Africans into Marrakesh and Rabat, then I will believe that you really are all for mass immigration,
Yeah, well,
Obviously, they
exactly.
would never accept that, and rightfully so, because it's their country, and such an invasion would be the end of their culture.
Yeah, I mean, this has been viewed, I think the cultural Marxists today, they view colonization and invasion as a very evil and wicked thing, but in this case, it's like the right thing to do, right? It's about leveling out and giving back, to people
Oh.
who's never had anything to do with this. But I mean, you're right. I mean, and think about this too. I mentioned this before, but again, it's like you have in Europe now, we have a situation where a lot of the people that come to Europe, if they would feel, let's say, uncomfortable, there's too many, white people there, right? They don't feel it's enough diversity or enough of people that look like them or what have you. They do have the option. Okay, there's a caveat here, which would be there are wars being fought with Western powers that is controlled by the same entities that we're talking about now, the banking system, the predatory class. These are not wars that are fought by the people of, you know, the West, because they have their interest. There's stupid military people who line up for this and they don't know better, etc. We have a problem there, and I recognize that, and that has to be fought. That is our responsibility as well. But the people that are coming in do have the option of going back to their country and saying, you know, if you want to have, you know, more of people like yourselves on television or more of them in the media, or if you feel uncomfortable that it's not fully your culture and whatnot, there's an option where, you know, the Taiwanese can go back to Taiwan, the Congolese can go back to Congo, etc. There are issues like that. But in Europe, this is now not the case. We are being dispossessed from our own lands. And the demographics are changing on such a rate that, of course, we see reflections of this, like white flight and what have you, for the very reason that it's not about that we hate other people and want nothing to do with them. In fact, I love different cultures. I love the diversity that actually exists on this planet. I wish to have it remaining so. And I love to go visit on these people. And it doesn't mean that we have to take everything that exists all around the other parts of the world and bring them into every single European country. But that's effectively what's happening. And there's no longer any all-white countries on the planet, pretty much, right? And this is the part of the critique, that there's, when this displacement occurs, when this eradication really occurs, then it's going to be gone forever, right? And it's something that's irreplaceable if we see, you know, their goals of population replacement truly occurring, right?
Absolutely. And I think you made a very balanced case there, because obviously there is the issue that Western nations have been and have allowed themselves to be used for imperialist adventures all over the place. So that obviously we do need to take a responsibility for, and especially the United States and Britain, of course, which are the main military powers involved in these issues nowadays. But the arrogance of immigrants coming over here and calling white people racist, and then complaining about diversity and not having enough diversity, and also especially of Islamist and not by far most, but you have these Wahhabist Islamists, these Salafists here in Europe. And these people, now you have in England and in Germany, you have people walking the streets in long robes, talking to people, German people or British people, telling them to comply with Sharia law. This is now actually happening.
Yeah.
And obviously this is completely unacceptable. And the arrogance with which what I noticed with many immigrants here in my own visit, in my own neighborhood and in the context that I have, like I said, calling white people racist, etc., and criticizing our cultural phenomenon. I know that nowadays it's happening in Sweden too with Pippi Langkaus.
We call her Pippi Longstrump, but longstockings, right? That's what you're thinking about?
Yeah, longstockings. Okay, so she's now racist also. The Black Peas here in Holland. These are racist because it's derogatory to black people, blah, 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 blah. Well, if you don't like our traditions, then go home.
That's right.
That's what I've got to tell to you.
It's very simple.
If you are going to be an immigrant here, and if you are going to be part of the wealth of the nation here, and if you're going to find good jobs for sustenance here and good social services, okay, all under attack, but still for as long as they're here, then shut up and join the party. But don't tell us how to run our country here, please.
Yeah.
And this is an immigrant has the duty, very simple, the duty to adapt. And this is the reason why mass immigration in the United States was a success in the 19th century. Immigrants were simply expected to learn English and find a job and shut up. And that's what we expect from immigrants here also.
Well, I think we're seeing the consequences of that in the United States now as well, because the same thing, I mean, let's be honest about the same thing has occurred there since the 1965 Immigration Act changed. It was about 90% white. And it was, I mean, the American dream was largely built by the Europeans that settled there. And in no way can you compare settlers, pioneers, and pilgrims to the migrants of today that usually end up, you know, going on welfare and, you know, getting, you know, food stamps and everything else. And yes, I know there are people who work. I'm not, you know, that stupid to comb everyone with the same, you know, or you know, push everyone over that same edge, if you will. But despite that, the circumstances of what occurred was very much different. And in all honesty, it doesn't matter. I mean, we, of course, recognize we need to look at this historically, but the matter of fact is you have to take it also by case-by-case issue. You can't say and put the guilt on people today in European nations for something that was done 200-300 years ago by our forefathers, there was a completely different mindset. It was a completely different view of what the earth was. Things weren't even mapped properly. There was an age of discovery. There was settlement was something to be proud of, and it was a very different scenario than what we see today. And some of these colonies were actually very small in comparison to in numbers and population, if we compare to the numbers of immigrants that are coming into Europe right now.
Absolutely. And not only that, but if you look at slavery, I mean, the two huge issues in slavery concerning this white guilt trip is that, in the first place, slavery was run by the Jews.
Yeah.
And it's the Jews that are all the time talking about the white man being the cancer of the planet. But the fact is, slavery was run by the Jews. So let's not mince words about these things. This is what happened. The Jews owned all the ships. They were the ones who opened the trade routes. And who were their biggest helpers? Well, the blacks in Africa, of course.
Yeah.
Who were enslaving neighboring tribes.
That's right.
So, I mean, this whole idea that the whites are responsible for slavery and that the blacks now have a right in America to endlessly guilt trip the whites about that is complete nonsense. And the blacks know this because people like Farrakhan, etc., a very good man in my view, he just talks about these issues openly. But, you know, we have been pitted against each other by often Jewish Marxists. And these people are telling us to hate each other. And unfortunately, we do. But we should be keeping the eye on the ball and in terms of our own rights, but also in terms of what the Jews are up to in many ways. And I'm not talking about the Jewish commoner, because Jewish commoner is just like the white commoner, a complete pig who doesn't know anything, but Jewish banking and certain factions within Jewry very much are at the heart of the whole issue and have been for a very long time now.
Yeah, I think it also goes back to the stigma of us having an idea that we need to save the world, we need to take care of everyone everywhere all the time, and it's like these are massive. I think we've been forced into modernity and the modern world, and with all its wonders of technology and transportation and everything else, we've been thrust into a scenario and situation where we feel, we feel guilt for the African farmer that's struggling, or for someone who's starving in another country. And it's not that we can't help each other. It's absolutely not about that. But this idea that all the world's problems are being poured over us when we watch the news, for example, and then we feel the guilt that we're part of that, we have to take care of that and all that stuff. But the fact is,
in a very superficial way,
obviously, of course, definitely, a very
just
superficial
bag of crisps and look at these poor black people, they're dying and starving, and then we move on to the next show, and that's it. We've had our 5 minutes of compassion, say,
the aid galas and all that stuff, nonsense. We know that, definitely. No, but just the idea of what I'm trying to get to is that I think on a psychological level, we are partially overwhelmed, and this is something that also makes us give up the option of doing something even around ourselves, right? We used to have an idea where you think more locally, you think, you interact with the people around you, you make decisions there. I mean, the communities is a way that humankind has lived for hundreds of thousands of years. And now this is something that has radically changed in the last 50, 60 years, really. And I think we're in a situation now where we don't really know how to deal with that. And we're grappling with that, and we're taking too much on too fast. And this is something that now has spiraled out of control. I think we need to take a deep breath, step back for a moment and think, all right, what is occurring around me? Because I mean, literally you can have people being concerned with people on the other part of the continent, but they have their neighbors starving to death next to them or freezing to death because the fuel costs have gone up. Right. And still these nations are like donating millions in aid and whatnot, have you? Because, I mean, I even think a small country as Sweden, just to make one more example, back in 2012, I pulled out the numbers for that. I think we donated over close to $2 billion alone to African aid. And this was about it from The Economist, I think, or something like that. And it was about the return. Where did nations invest in Africa, and what did they see a return? And amazingly, Sweden was like part of the top 10 list in aid donations to Africa, which is, incredible when you think about what is happening within Sweden itself, within the country. where, you know, pensioners are being forced out. People are starving to death. They can't even, we're not even taking care of our own old people anymore, you know? And it's like, it's too dispersed. It's too spread out. And we need to contract back again. Doesn't mean an isolationist view, but it means that if you take care of yourself and the immediate people around you first, you're in a much better position to even begin to try to help someone else. And this is just completely failed by design, of course, I think.
Very much so. And, you know, I think, you know, my website is about usury, and it's not for nothing, because I really believe that the predatory nature of our monetary system is really at the very heart of the whole matter. And we all know that these banking titans rule the whole planet, and that all these multinational industries that are owned by the banks, that they are the real power. And as long as people just blithely go to work in the morning for Riksbank or for Shell or what have you, these kind of corporations, and next complain about, they're just clueless. We really, really, really need to very fundamentally reconsider what kind of economy that we want, and not thinking about economics in a fundamental way, not about how do I get more money, but how does money work? How does it work against us? Because it now very much works against us. This is really at the core of our whole predicament. And if we stop feeding the banks, because what the problem is that the trillions that these banks rake in with their usury, that's where they finance all this feminism, all this mass immigration, all this homo lobby, which is another plague that is a disgusting plague that is paraded before us. Of course, their control of the mass media, and of course, normal people not being able to develop alternatives. Because if you go to a bank and ask for a loan for an interest-free credit-based unit, then obviously you're not going to get a loan.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, we need to create our own, start creating our own infrastructures and reconsider our dependency on these megalomaniac outfits, whether it's for our money, our food, our telecommunications, etc., because we're all beholden to these multinationals and their so-called services. And as long as that is the case, we continue to be simply mind controlled and enslaved.
Yeah, we have no conception even of ourselves anymore. We're very destabilized of who we are as individuals and who we are in terms of the group and our nation, yeah, our country and our people and all that stuff. We don't know our history. This is all by design. We've been uprooted, you know.
And yeah, it's very important, what you say, because these are very fundamental issues. How do we see ourselves? How do we interact with other people around us? What is our place in the group?
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's only a few hundred years ago that people lived in extended families and in tribes, and this is the natural way of organizing for people. And first the extended family was destroyed and the tribe was destroyed, and now the core family, the nuclear family, is being destroyed with feminism.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it's just getting worse and worse, and
You're right. I mean, exactly. This is just the reality of the situation. And despite that, a lot of people who are, well, I feel really it's a disconnection from nature, from the real world. I think a lot of people actually are, they live literally in a constructed bubble of what they think reality is, and there's no application anymore. I mean, I watched just a quick anecdote. I watched a show of someone try to go back to, I think it was 1850s. They tried to live as settlers again in Canada, somewhere on the west coast there. And you know, they decided to uproot their lives, and they decided to dedicate 1 year of their life to live as a settler coming to Canada for the first time. And they showed this progress through filming it. It was back in the 90s, I think. But it was very interesting to see this, because it showed that the nature of the work that was done around them immediately, you know, turned out to the quote-unquote old stereotype gender roles, right? It was basically the women said, it's like, there's a reason why, you know, men did a certain thing and women did certain other things. So it's just like, I don't have physical strength that it takes, you know, to do certain tasks that needs to be done for us to survive, you know? And today, a lot of the feminist groups, they think that this is somehow based in, you know, they call our roles artificial, but the fact is they are based in reality. They are based on biology. And these are things that today, with our modern academic, you know, fraudulent, you know, fields, try to claim are all constructed artificial things. And I mean, how do you, How do you even debate with someone who's so detached from reality they don't even recognize that there are biological differences between men and women? I mean, there's no point, right? Where do you
But
go?
to be honest, you know, I've been discussing feminism on Facebook a lot, and the simple fact is, women who are really seriously involved with feminism, they all suffer from huge personality problems. There can be absolutely zero doubt about this. And Marxist ideologies like feminism usually attract women who are already pretty messed up, to put it bluntly. And it's a heinous ideology, and it's from victimhood and this narcissist attitude of choosing for your own happiness, and I've been so oppressed by men. But the simple fact is that women need men to survive, not the other way around. The species needs women, so that's another issue. But men don't need women to survive. Women need men to survive. And not only on a material plane, but also on a spiritual plane, because men are simply more spiritual. They're more rational and more spiritual, and women are more earthly and more emotional. And if you let women and female values control your society, then you will get exactly what we have today. And this gynocentrism that we have today, where female values like comfort and security and predictability, these are things that are good for females. When they are, when these are the values that that are worshipped, and values like aggression, creativity, warriorship, warriorhood, I mean, when these values, typical male values, when these are scoffed at, because that is what we have today, they are simply disrespected and scoffed at. While there has never been more need for them than today, but they're simply scoffed at. Then you will have huge problems in society, and the narcissism that we see in women today, talking about equality and claiming leadership positions in society without having any merit at all, this is something that we really definitely need to get rid of. And men will very much have to play a huge part in this also, because the way that men worship women and are enslaved by their second chakra, their groin, is simply pathetic. And as long as men will continue to drool over pretty women, then we will continue to be in the mess that we are in.
Well, I mean, think about it. I mean, the reality of the situation is that men can pose a real threat to the organized crime syndicate that we faced. And this is the very reason why they, first of all, break up the family and, you know, prevent us from, you know, organize on any kind of level. Not only that, men are being, you know, emasculated and feminized from mm-hmm. chemicals to the very behavior of the role models that we see on TV. It's a full-on attack on that. And again, I think people who don't recognize why the elite is doing that, and they see it as some kind of win, I mean, they're part of the problem. They're part of those who are trying to enslave all of mankind. They don't see the dynamic relationship between men and women, that there's a balanced function there, which mm-hmm. if was correct, would actually be something that would be beneficial to helping mm-hmm. to destabilize the power center that we have attacking us. So it has to be recognized there that men has to toughen up, you know, men has to get together, they have to start organizing, they have to realize that they have power to do things. But if they don't, I don't see much hope, to be honest, because that's where it lies right now.
Listen, if they can't even control their own women, then what kind of chance do they stand against the plutocracy? So no, men definitely have to stand up, and they have to start organizing also amongst themselves, because men are too focused on finding relationships. And what you often see with men in my own personal life experience is that you have a great friendship, then they get a woman, and all of a sudden you never hear from them again. And, they fear coming home late after have some good boozing in the pub, because they're afraid of what the missus will say. And this is the kind of carry on going on. And this is the brotherhood of men has been broken, and men cannot rely on each other anymore. And if you get into trouble with your woman, you're most likely to get backstabbed by your male friends also, even your male family. I've experienced this myself, but I've seen this also many times with men in similar situations, and of course with the feminist-induced divorce epidemic that we have nowadays. You see it happening all the time, and you see how completely out of control these women are also after the divorce, in keeping children away, making life still miserable for their ex, etc., etc., all helped by the feminist police state. And the men amongst each other they cannot talk to each other unless they have been there themselves, because most men who have never been there, they don't empathize, they don't relate to it, they're still too busy watching porn, living the good life of the bachelor, and they're
Right.
clueless about the serious matters of life. And
Yeah.
because also, and I think that this is an important issue, because there is no initiation into manhood anymore these days. I
No,
mean, you
no.
know, in traditional cultures, at some point you become, you get 12, or you start, when your voice starts to lower, you become a man and you're initiated into manhood with some test, or you're now part of the brotherhood, and you know, you learn a trade and you learn about manhood, you learn about courage, you learn about endurance, these male qualities, you learn about war. And that is, we need to reconnect this to this manliness again, and how to encourage and develop manliness, because that is absolutely what we need so much today.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm glad you mentioned that, and there's a real lack of that sense of brotherhood, and if it does exist, here's what is interesting. It comes usually then in the form of some kind of secret society, like the Freemasons, for example, or similar organization where you have primarily a Judaic mythology being imposed as opposed to our own native, European traditions. I mean, this would be true for anyone around the world, really. But nonetheless, we're in Europe. That's what we're talking about right now. And the very aspect that we've been disconnected from our own mythology. I mean, I thought about this the other day. Think about it, even down to the comic books and things like that. We used to have a tradition where we talked about our ancestors, we talked about our heroes, our those great men that were role models of our own society, of our own tribe, what have you. That were talked about. Today, we're reading, about some weird genetic creature, for X-Men type thing or whatever, like some completely made up fantasy aspect of something that's been dreamt up by someone 100 miles away. And there's no, I mean, I'm not saying it's bad. Of course you can read a comic book, but the very aspect that it's been a, I think, an effective weapon and a tool in displacing your very mind from your own people, that's very worrying. And that's very, very strange that that's occurred under such a short period of time when we used to have, strong traditions and talk about them,
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, where did it all go wrong, huh?
Yeah, well,
Jesus.
exactly.
Well, it started maybe around this 1500 era when Catholicism and the landed gentry, of course, was a tyranny also. Let there be no mistake about that. And that is what you always see. Yeah. So the money power and its henchmen, they always pick on a problem that is already there. And they blow it totally out of proportion, and they spin it in a direction that they want.
Yeah.
And that is, and then that is. So there were real problems, but what they did to it was make it even only worse, of course. And but we really need to reconnect to that stage where we of that when Western civilization was probably at its peak in the late 15th century, and see. Yeah, well, what went wrong with the rise of banking and of this money debt aristocracy that started to take over, including its materialist mindset? And because of, okay, you can say Christianity of already was an attack on local custom, and that's a
Yeah,
very good point.
it was.
But at least it was spiritual, you know. Nowadays, we're saddled with materialism, which is obviously a total no-go.
Yeah, it's almost like I see a progression, though. I got to say that. I mean, I personally take it way, further back, as you just mentioned, before incoming Christianity, and around 1,000 in the northern countries, a little bit before that, 900, perhaps, you have a real, incursion of Christianity and a major destruction and slaughter of the people. But nonetheless, my point of being that I think that we have to realize that the progression of Christianity has come in such a way that it's been slowly moving towards materialism. There has been, Catholicism, which was more based on, pagan deities. Then you had Reformation, Protestantism, and then you did have a more, I mean, the first scientists were really, they were, kind of naturalists, but they were really studying God, right? And you had Calvinism and some of the other kind of classifications coming out of that, where you've seen a kind of a taking away, right? If you move from Catholicism to Protestantism, you had a rich, array of deities or saints in this case. You had a lot of imagery and things like that. When you slowly come over to Protestantism and Calvinism and Puritanism, etc., you basically had complete, you know, clean white walls with just one cross on it. It's kind of turning into minimalism to a certain extent, and it's about removing all the imagery. And I feel really that our scientificism has really come out of that environment where it's very clean and clinical, and the white robes are on, and you know, it's like
interesting.
Yeah, so it's I don't know, it's something about the mindset. We need to go back into the imagery of our pre-Christian heritage and kind of try to awaken some of those spirits. That's where I put a lot of trust in a way, but that could be debated, I guess.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting point, and I think it's very much at the mind of many people at the moment. And, you know, I have really found wonderful spirituality in Christianity. So I have great affection for Christ, but not in a Catholic way, or let alone a Protestant way, but more in a way that I've learned to appreciate the real message of Christ, which was very much about your own personal contact with the divine in meditation and prayer, because that's really what it's all about. And this tradition is really the underlying esoteric tradition, I think, of all major religions, between quotes. That ultimately the spirit is alive within us, and that is where we find love and wisdom and personal growth. And if you meditate on that, and if you pray, and if you build this this kind of spiritual rapport with the divine within yourself, and I think, yeah, that is what I've come to see as basically the underlying current of all the spiritual traditions. But that is my take. So I'm not too beholden to the ancient gods, but I'm absolutely convinced that the old pagan gods, whether it's Celtic or Nordic or German, you know, they all have their own specific interpretations of these pagan laws, pagan deities, etc. But I think all these traditions also very much had this spirit within kind of spirituality.
Sure. Well, exactly. I was just going to say, I think the, you know, what you're connecting with that you're mentioning is very much a personal thing. And I think that is a reflection of an essence that existed before organized Christianity existed. And it's something which, you know, you see reflected, as you say, in pagan traditions. And I like the diversity there too. I like the idea that there's so much difference, so much to choose from to a certain extent. But let's just switch for a moment here a little bit and go over to So a couple of more things I wanted to run by you here. What about Muslim banking? They have a very strong tradition of being anti-usury. How do you view this? And is this something that's viable as a something to be imported into the West? How do you view this?
No, it's not viable, because the Catholic and the Islamic economies both had usury prohibition. But the reason why they failed, and the Islamic economy failed also, is simply because they did not organize interest-free monetary systems. So they just prohibited usury. And the problem that this created was that the rich wouldn't lend. So as a result of this, there was credit scarcity in the economy, both in the Catholic economy of the medieval era and nowadays in the Islamic communities. Islamic banking is not interest free. Okay, it is not official usury in the sense of 5 or 10% per year, but when you look at the total cost for capital after a mortgage has been paid off, then you will see that the real cost of the loan was approximately the same as 150% that we pay in a usurious credit system. So Islamic banking, it does not really lower capital cost for capital, is usurious, and it's really a key lesson of history that that both the Catholic economy of the medieval era and the Islamic economies did not provide a rational monetary system. They just printed money in whatever way, either coining specie or copper or whatever. Or nowadays, obviously, in Islamic countries, they have modern monetary systems. But they just coin money, they let that circulate. But because they only look at money circulating and not at credit, they were never able to really solve the usury issue.
Yeah.
My response. And then the answer, therefore, is that is therefore also very important for us in the resistance. We must develop, and this has already been developed, because if you start looking into my website on my interest-free economics page, You will see that I have discussed basically all major monetary reform programs, and I've very extensively discussed how you can create interest-free credit through a process that I call mutual credit. And this is not the only way that you can create an interest-free economy. Can you also work with demurrage? It's also a very viable alternative. But how to provide interest-free credit to the economy is really a core question that that any freedom-loving person must learn to address.
Yeah, I agree. What about someone like Hjalmar Schacht, for example, the success of the German model under National Socialism? And just a caveat here too, I know a lot of people claim that there was, basically Rothschild money behind here. There were other, Warburgs, etc. And we have focused on that in previous programs to dispel those kinds of myths as well, because on top of that, of course, we have it just an immense amount of Allied propaganda that has hit.
Absolutely.
Us the last 70 years, and there's a tremendous important reason for that, and also a reason why Germany has been so utterly demonized, and why this topic has become the one topic that you're not allowed to touch at all. I mean, in fact, we did a show with the filmmaker Dennis Wise about his film The Greatest Story Never Told, and that's basically what got us booted off iTunes. That they censored us after that show we did, and we just openly and honestly talking about what happened and why it happened and what occurred there. But these are those kinds of, no touch areas. So you realize that there's something lying underneath there, which is very, very sensitive. What about the German model, Hjalmar Schacht?
Yeah, well, there was a, this introduction is important because obviously you cannot seriously discuss the Second World War if you have not digested fully the revisionist take of the whole situation, yeah? So including the Holocaust narrative, etc. And I have studied the revisionist literature extensively because I've always been engrossed in wartime history. But late last year, I published three articles called Hitler's Finances, and in which I think for the first time, extensively analyzed the German monetary system. And like I was saying earlier, it was the Money Masters film that opened me up to this whole business. And you have this famous quote in the conspiracy industry called, "Give me control of a nation's money, and I do not care who makes the law." You
Rothschild,
undoubtedly
what?
have heard of this.
Yeah, sure.
And this is the key lesson, I think, of the whole conspiracy scene, the most fundamental lesson that we must come to terms with. And analyzing the German monetary system, and this was very interesting, showed that in fact Hjalmar Schacht was indeed a money power agent. Without a shadow of a doubt, he was a wealthy aristocrat and a very close friend of Bank of England chief Montague Norman, and actually visited Norman just before the war broke out in September 39, which beggars the question, what were they discussing? Well, amongst other things, they were discussing the founding of the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, which is the apex of the international banking cartel. And Hjalmar Schacht was a founding board member of this, and his successor, Walter Funk, was also a leading board member. And the German monetary system was simply fractional reserve banking with usury, and it was exactly the same as under Weimar. And Hjalmar Schacht had already led the Reichsbank under Weimar for, I think, maybe 6 or 7 years. And this is very interesting because obviously there is huge populist power in the Hitler story. Yeah? Let me absolutely not make that away. But the bottom line is that the monetary system of Germany during the Second World War and in the years before that was a completely normal banker-based monetary system. And what Hjalmar Schacht did, he did not attack usury, which is interest on loans of money. But he solved the depression. And why do we have depressions? Because of deflation. So a depression is really nothing else but a deflating money supply. It's absolutely nothing else. All the rest is just banker bullshit and economist blathering. What happens in a crashing economy is that the money supply is going down. And this was happening very much in Germany also, of course, in the early 30s, with all the known consequences with high unemployment, etc., which led to the rise of Hitler. And Hitler's economic program was based on that of Gottfried Feder. And Gottfried Feder was a huge leading light, economically speaking, and a great genius, and who had a very clear perspective on banking, usury, how we were all interest slaves. He has this book, Breaking the Shackles of Interest Slavery, something like that. And it was this program that basically got Hitler to power. But when Hitler got to power, he did not put Feder in charge of the economy, but Hjalmar Schacht. And this is a very important issue. And the question is still out there. Why did he sideline Feder? Well, the answer to that is clear, because he was forced to do so by his industrial backers. And why did he allow Schacht to run the economy? And probably this was because Schacht promised that he would solve the depression. And Schacht solved this in a very simple way: print more money. Easiest thing in the world. And he did this with his MIFO bills. And this solved the depression and got Germany back to full employment in no time again. And we could do this today again, also in Europe and in America. Make no mistake, we could solve the depression tomorrow. And not even with ending usury, which would be the best thing, of course, but by simply providing real liquidity, not to banks, as is now happening with quantitative easing, which is just highway robbery, but to Main Street. Small and medium business, provide them with all the credit they need, and you will see a booming economy within a year. So this is a very crucial bit of information that I inserted in the narrative, which is currently taking over the truth movement, integrating revisionism, which I very much support in many ways, because the Allied Archetype, that wartime archetype that now parades as history, is obviously complete nonsense.
It
But so we
is.
can agree on that. But this whole Schacht figure is really pivotal in the whole Hitler story. And my analysis of him is not so positive.
Well, that's interesting. I definitely want to read more about your articles there. I just know as well that he was, of course, he was in the environment, much earlier than the rise of the National Socialists. And I think as well that I think some there's a couple of factors we have to take into account, and one is, of course, people immediately, when you begin talking about this, they go to the fabricated version of National Socialism, and they go to that version of what, they perceive happened afterwards, meaning they're implying them before the fact, right? They're implying them that, okay, whatever they did in, let's say, 19, 35 or even 1929 or something like that, was the same thing. They had this planned all the way, right? I don't think that's the case. I think it's more of a scenario where they realized that they had to be playing chess as well here, even to attain the political power that they did. And I think a smart move in this is, of course, to already use people that were established economists within the structure. They were there and they were existent. And as you say, they did manage to change the scenario. And even if it wasn't ideal, something did occur, something incredible, financially did happen there. And I think that we have to view it in a different capacity and think about it that, they wanted to try to get the power that they wanted to be able to control politically. And I think that they would have done themselves a great disservice to boot everyone out around them immediately. I think that would turn them into pariahs quicker. So, I mean, in the 1930s, they were politicians, right, as everyone else. And they were dealing with the same, problems to a certain extent that politicians today deal with. And I think we tend to forget that, right? We tend to go for the extremist version of events right away and think, oh my God, that's what they had planned all along. And I don't think that's the case at all.
Well,
So it's very difficult,
I can relate to that very much, Henrik. But I think that the key question here is, why did the bankers work with Hitler?
Well, again, because he was a politician, because he was running Germany at the time. And it's kind of the same thing as you look at a photo of him shaking hands with the British Prime Minister at the time, or the royal family in England, and that people imply, see, they were working together with the Nazis. It was like, no, he's a politician. This is what you did at the time. The breakout of the war, of course, changed things dramatically, but it doesn't imply them ahead of time. I think we're jumping the timeline then, and that's the mistake we tend to do. And we forget that they were just, politicians that were trying to do what they wanted to do and run the country,
Yeah, I understand. And what my position in this is that when you first start reading the revisionist literature and especially the Holocaust story, is of course very shocking when you find out that this all just a load of crap. And but also Hitler's politics, the economic story that we're discussing, but also the early adventures, say the Anschluss, which was a very which was not a crime at all, but absolutely warranted, and basically Germany and Austria should probably reunite today too. But so Hitler was just bringing Germans back into the Reich, into the German Empire. There was nothing wrong with that, and we definitely need to reestablish that. But on the other hand, what I do see happening now is that people go overboard and they say, "Oh, Hitler was so right, and he was right with locking the Jews up because they were a fifth column and this and that, and he was right in the war too. He wanted peace. Hitler wanted peace." I don't believe that. He wanted peace in the West. There's no doubt about that. Hitler absolutely wanted peace with Britain. But I think that Hitler was preparing war with Russia. And I think that that is the reason why the bankers worked with him, because that is what they wanted too. And I think people are going a little overboard in appreciating Hitler today, because what he did was, okay, he made a matter of the Jewish question, but he locked up in concentration camps. He didn't kill them. Let that be clear. But he locked them up for slave labor, the Jewish common man. And he did not end banking, which is the real issue. Because the Jews that we when we talk about the Jews, we talk about trillionaires, banking families, and they had little to fear from the Hitler experiment, as is shown by my analysis of the monetary system, and also by the strategic imperative of the Second World War, namely the Russo-German conflict, which was very much what the bankers were after.
Yeah, interesting. I definitely want to read more. I know you had a couple of articles about that. I didn't time to get to all of them yet, but I definitely want to read more about that, because I want to try to, not only understand the situation, but be fair to it and realize, I just want to know what happened, and I just realized that it's so incredibly muddied with all the Allied propaganda out there, and the very aspect that you're like not allowed even to touch it, which bothers me tremendously as well. And
Yeah.
I feel that there's definitely something that is. There's a reason for that, but of course that doesn't mean, one thing or the other, but it means that we have to try to get to the truth and realize what happens. But I still have to say that I think there's a great deal of diplomacy, I guess, that occurs around this time as well, because on that end of things, I think that they knew what they had to do to achieve the political gain. I think if they would have, ousted too many too quickly, they wouldn't even have attained the position that they did. The question you can pose, of course, and I think that's where you're going with this, is, all right, but even at the time when they did attain the power and had it for themselves, at what time would they even have, changed the monetary policy and the monetary system and questioned things like usury? So that's very interesting. I definitely need to read more about that, Anthony. But let's see if there's something else we want to touch upon here a little bit towards the end of the second segment here. There's a lot of other things, of course, we can and could talk about, from the gold issue to the I guess European Central Bank and where that's going. I guess we can just can ask you, what do you think is the most important thing that we've kind of left out that people should know about? Something which I guess is pertinent to where we're going right now, if we don't change the model here of economics. Is the system going to crash? And if so, when? Because we're all waiting for that, right? So, yeah.
Well, the system is going to crash. There's absolutely zero doubt about that. And the only question is indeed when, and it's going to be soon. Sooner rather than later, because what you see now in the United States is that the statistics look good, so-called low unemployment. All complete lies, because real unemployment in the United States is anywhere between 25 and 30% if you use the statistical methods that were in use 30 years ago. But the statistics look good. They have a huge bubble on the New York Stock Exchange, which is of course complete baloney, all blown with quantitative easing money. And they have managed to create these statistics, but it's not sustainable. And normally speaking, if you look at the classical way that the central banks would be dealing with statistics that we're seeing now, is that they would be raising rates, interest rates. And this is what we can expect from the Fed in the coming months. And this will have a devastating effect on the international financial markets, particularly because of the derivative trade, which is all based on interest rates. And I expect that this raise in rates will have a devastating effect on the global economy, which is the goal, because they are taking down the United States empire, and they are harmonizing income levels all over the world. Europe and the United States are being brought down to Brazil level, and that is what we will be seeing in the coming 10 years, and Europe will be a radically different place in 10 years from now. That is what I expect, and even more so in the United States, which will be even much worse off. But the crunch is going to continue, and as long as the people are just going to howl for revolution, then that is what they will get, and this revolution will end in exactly the same way as all the other revolutions ended: in more power centralization, in more communist adventures, and more centralization within the EU. The euro crisis itself, I think that this is a noteworthy point to take note of for the listeners, is that the euro crisis itself is completely artificial. I mean, when they started the euro, they knew that the credit crunch was going to come. And they also knew that Germany was going to outperform all the other economies so that they would have a balance of payments disbalance. Importing euros and exporting goods and services, as a result of which the Spanish and Greek and Italian and also French economies were being gutted from basically capital, from euros in circulation. And this is what leads to this huge debt crisis in Southern Europe. And the reason why the European Union is still continuing in this vein is simply because they want to extort the nations into surrendering budget responsibility to Brussels. So we already have a federal state now, with the constitution. Okay, it's not the constitution; it's now the Lisbon Treaty, because the constitution was rejected by France and the Netherlands in 2005. But they went on with the Lisbon Treaty, and they have all what they need for the state. For a European state, but the real issue is budgets, national budgets, and as long as the capitals of the nation still have control of their own budgets, they're still in control in the European Union. But the European Union now wants a fiscal union, meaning that Brussels will control the national budgets so that it can start redistribution from the north to the south, which is in itself not unreasonable, because the euro itself redistributes from the south to the north, so that must stop. But it's implicit in a white currency zone, and Brussels wants to force the nations into this budgets in surrendering budget sovereignty, and then they will have their full-blown European super state, and that is what they're trying to build, and that is what we as nationalists and as the resistance should make clear to the people, that this is the goal and that this is what we not want. And people don't want this because the European Union is simply hated everywhere. But we have to make clear to the people that this euro crisis is just completely contrived, and that the banks are really the power behind the scenes, and that the banks are, of course, messing up our economies and are destroying our living standards. And we will have to fight for monetary reform. And I believe that, all the opposition forces that we see now, the faux opposition that we see now, like for instance the Front National in France, or the UKIP in Britain, or Geert Wilders, of course, in Holland, that is all complete faux opposition, because they only bash immigrants. Okay, I agree with bashing immigration, but I don't agree with bashing immigrants, and I also don't agree with Islam bashing, although I am not Islamist and I'm not really interested in religion.
Well,
But
the problem there is, I think, in a way, that they're only focused on Islam, it seems, really.
exactly.
And I mean, we know that Geert Wilders and some of these are definitely controlled Zionist opposition. We have, the situation in Sweden where the Swedish Democrats are very pro-Israel, for example, and there's huge questions there. But despite all that, I have a tendency to view it as there's still signs of something positive within Europe, and the fact that they're pro-European, but they're anti-European Union. And unfortunately, they are the only political option, no matter how painful that realization
that
is.
That is the design then, eh?
Yeah,
So
but
this is how you mess up the debate. You make a valuable point about mass immigration, and then you go ahead Islam bashing. So normal people with a clue, they think, okay, I'm against immigration, but is this Islam bashing really, really necessary?
No,
And
I
that is
think.
how to split the opposition.
Yeah, I think what needs to be done there is that there needs to be more political viable alternatives. I guess I still view it in such a way that if you can walk the path a certain stretch together because you have a common goal, that's fine. I mean, there's a tendency within human civilization that's why we get these major polarized, you know, kind of movements, because the lesser ones that have too much, you know, their disagreements, let's say. But if it gets too much shattered and splintered up, the other side that coalesces all the groups that they can on their side will completely run over you. And that's why we have this tendency of it sucks together to these huge polarized issues, which is very unfortunate, but it has developed as a political strategy. And at this stage, I don't see how to move yourself outside of that and get all the people with you, you know, because what can be done here is we can move in the same direction for a little bit on that road. Then you can split off. Then you can, of course, say, well, on this issue, we have to change this thing. So on this issue, we have to change this. I guess I see it. Do you think it would be too much uphill to have a new party formed? A new party needs to begin to, you know, gain traction on the, let's say, the immigration issue and getting us out of the European Union, first of all, as opposed to leading the charge with the power that's already there and then split off afterwards. I'm still, you know, grappling with some of these questions, you know, but you see what I mean, right?
I understand exactly what you're saying, Henrik, and obviously you make a very valid point. There's no doubt about it. But if I look at people like Geert Wilders, all I can say is go home. I will never commit to this guy, never work with him. And what I think is necessary is a more broadly developing real populist platform for people outside of the current parties. Because all the parties are so corrupt and so within the box. And I think that it should be about the issues and not even so much about a political party, but a clear-cut populist populist platform centering around monetary reform, first and foremost, mass immigration and anti-EU. These are the two absolute biggies. And then a more traditionalist mindset based on basic spirituality and anti-materialist and pro-family. And if you have these three basic issues, I think you can really reach a whole lot of people out there. And I think that we should slowly but surely start formulating such manifestos with these basic points and just keep hammering these home. Because, yeah, if I look at what is now being offered in terms of monetary reform, it's totally non-existent. Nobody
right.
talks about the monetary system. Nobody talks
no.
about the banks.
No.
Whereas these are the problem. So, I mean, and as long as that is not really part of the agenda, then I'd say we're just pissing in the wind.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think it would be awesome if there was a mass awakening, you know, and the masses, you know, realize what was going on. And that might be a bit attainable. I'm not necessarily very pessimistic about it. I just know that a lot of people are followers. They attend to attract to whatever, you know, thing is in place at the time. And the downside, of course, of all these political movements and the parties and everything that's out there, no matter where they are on this fence, we all know that they're rotten to the core. But the reality of the situation is that no matter how much we dislike them, they still influence our lives every day. And the longer we're part of this insanity and moving deeper and deeper into the trenches of the European Union, the more we're going to get dragged down. And the question is, of course, all right, do we just kind of let it all go until it crashes? Or do we try to influence it on every single level that we can all the time, you know, having working on multiple fronts at the same time? And I think at this stage, I think I would take the latter, and I would say, okay, even if there's one core issue I would agree with, you know, let's find that point of agreement. And then after that has been reached, let's splinter off and see what the next issue is. Because I don't see a broad mass awakening on all the issues you mentioned right now to gain traction even in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. And by that stage, where we're going to be when it comes to the European Union, is it going to be too late? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Oh yeah, very much so. And we can absolutely not afford to just sit there and wait until it all burns, because obviously, and this is also something that people want to take note of more than they do, they think the system is going to crash because of its own problems. And this is to some extent true, but they don't realize that the handlers are very much aware of this also.
Course, yeah.
If the system crashes, then they have their plans. They have the new system ready in the curtains to be unveiled and saying, oh, well, we have this problem, now we have this, you know?
Yeah.
And if we don't have our own alternatives on all levels, then we're just going to be sitting ducks. And that is how it looks as it stands now, of course. But I'm also very much like what you're just saying, addressing all these issues on all the fronts that the war is being brought to us, because that is what's basically happening. They are bringing the war to us on all thinkable levels. And there is no front that we can say, oh, well, we won't fight back here, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, you're right. I mean, I definitely agree with that. I think we have an immense task ahead of us to bring something in place, of setting something up, even if it's on a very basic platform, if that's what you want to call it. It might not even be political to a certain extent. It might just be a way of living your life, basically, that is successful, like creating a community or what have you, something that is in place that by the time it's already happening. I mean, the moral decay is just, I mean, it's rotten to the core right now. But I think as worse and worse it gets, more and more people are going to be attracted to other working models that already exists out there. And I think that's the challenge. Have
Yes.
something there which is basically ready to go in the wings. It doesn't mean that it has to be pushed on anybody. It doesn't mean that it has to, you have to do this and that. It's just something that have to stand the test of time. And I think a resurgence of traditionalism in this age of just, run amok progressivism is actually something which is sound and something that could be based on,
Yes.
a natural order of sorts, and something that actually recognizes the humanity that we have in us, because that's something that's forgotten in our age. And I think that we just have to live by example and show the way, basically. I think that in itself, hopefully, will attract people to it,
Absolutely, and I think that traditionalism is already very much visible on the political map, even though it's not in parties or whatever. But it's very clear that, for instance, in France, you have Dieudonné, and he's reaching the millions of people. Okay, also with revisionist history, but also with traditionalism. And in Hungary, you have this party led by Jobbik, I think he's called. In the United States, you have a clear-cut new right, they call it there, but also traditionalist. And I think that this is something, especially in France with the homo marriage that they managed to foist on the French, that really went down very badly. And they have been crossing lines, and people are more and more conscious of the direct assault on our basic way of living together. And the Marxists, they have the media behind them, but they do not have the people behind them. And we see this already in the disconnect between the elites and the people. And you see it in the recent catastrophe that was the European election, the catastrophe for the powers that be, that is. And this will only get worse. And the trick for us is indeed living by example, but also getting knowledge out there, clear-cut, integrated thinking that addresses the major issues from a spiritual level, from a traditionalist level, from an economic level, etc. And yeah, building from there.
You know what we need? We need, of course, another. We need the European Renaissance, right? Because
So, yeah.
I mean, I'm really concerned with the direction of where Europe is going, and I believe that, if the European peoples were stand up and basically head in the right direction of not only, development. I'm not talking about technological progress only and these kinds of issues, but revising their purpose and ambitions. I mean, I think we're going through that catharsis period right now of where things have just run amok and we've been sleeping for way too long. And now, something has snuck in and there's something we need to deal with. And I think in that process, I think we could revise ourselves to a certain extent and gain a new understanding of what we need to do, and it has to do with our identity too, because that's been forgotten. It's something that's been eroded since the Second World War, but I also think that the well, I guess the gifts, for the lack of a better term, that could be achieved if we had a system that actually had the best interest for our people at heart would be beneficial to everyone, instead of, you know, funding programs on political correctness and, you know, pushing diversity in every little, you know, field that we can have. And I mean, what happened to putting funds into real tangible projects and things that actually result in something? Every ounce of energy and time and effort right now is basically pushing on deconstructing the very human nature of, and it's like, it's all about inclusiveness all the time, and you can't choose, you can't do this, you can't do that. And it's just like, we're going nowhere here, you know, we're going backwards, in fact, you know?
Yeah, it's inclusiveness for foreigners and for women, but where are the men going? And manhood is very much under attack, as we have been discussing. But, you know, as a final thought here, maybe, Henrik, to introduce, because we've been discussing the problems of usury, but we've also got to work towards something. Yeah? And one part of the mind control that we suffer from is the idea that we are well off. We have it so good here in Sweden or in Holland or whatever.
Right,
you know?
I'm
sure that you hear that this also a lot in Sweden.
Oh, yeah.
The problem is, like I was already saying, the common man in the medieval era worked 15 weeks per year. And that was with medieval technology. He was a bigger man than a British man born in 1900. He achieved greater physical height. He would travel the entire continent in his 200 days per year that he was free. He would just start walking. And he traveled the entire continent by foot, and he studied, and he became learned, you know, as well as possible. And if we create an interest-free economy that does not allow up to 80% of the workers' production to be sucked up by the plutocracy, by the trillionaires, through their taxation, their usury, their artificial scarcity. The abundance that we can create as normal working people, we can work for 15 weeks per year and we can have a living standard that is maybe 5 times higher than we have now for normal people, and not for the millionaires, because they will have to give in a little. But the kind of, and we can have that kind of living standards. We can have architecture. Look at what these medieval people were building. You know, the Stockholm is a fantastic example of, you know, so much of the old buildings are still there in the old city center. And that is what our ancestors were building at the time. The buildings that we have been building over the last two generations will be gone in 100 years.
I certainly hope so, because they stink and they look ugly. That's why, you know.
Very, very much I agree. But how is it possible that in that day and age they were able to create huge buildings, very pretty buildings that stand the test of time, last for centuries?
You know, I was thinking about that. We were down in Strasbourg. That's right, Strasbourg, and we looked at the cathedral there, and I was just. That's the thought that occurred to me there. It's like people are still like coming from all parts of the world to see this magnificent cathedral, this building that's standing there. And what are we doing today with our, you know, if we look at the architectural of what we can achieve and things like that, it's like, what happened? You know, how did we go so backwards and create so many ugly things in this modern world? You know, it really struck me.
Well, usury happened, and let me give you an example of how this affects building, because the problem with usury is it's a percentage per year. So every year that you have a loan outstanding, it becomes more and more expensive. And this creates a drive to pay off as quickly as possible. And the more capital intensive an industry is, the more usury plays a part. And building is very capital intensive, and it transpires that up to 75% of building costs are cost for capital. And think about that, you know, what it would do if we take out cost for capital out of the production chain, and this need to have it done as quickly as possible so that we can repay the loan as quickly as possible. Because what happened with this cathedral that you were mentioning, and was happening all over Europe at the time, people would start building in 1300, and by 1400 or so, they were done. So they took a century to build such a project.
Yeah.
And now think what we would be building if we could build for a century with our current technology.
Right. Yeah. long term long term thinking again needs to be in the picture.
Long term thinking, long term investment, no short term capital costs that need to be managed. No, just interest-free credit, long-term building to express our love of the creator, of nature, or whatever, you know, whatever cultural aim that you have. It would be a revelation. And we should stop thinking in terms of, oh, we're off so well. No, we're not off well. We work 40 hours a week, 40 weeks a year. In America, it's even 50 weeks. And we slave away as wage slaves, as interest slaves, and most of our life force is taken from us. And we should be thinking where we would have been without capitalism. And that is what we should start thinking about. We should start visualizing the wealth and the affluence that we would be creating for all people, and not just the rich and famous, no, but for all normal people. And it would be a revelation.
A very good point. I think we should wrap things up on that note. I just want to add, I mean, you're right there. I mean, we're really, we're in a time where we're celebrating mediocrity, and we've settled for the situation we're in. You're right. You're like, we have it pretty good. And they always, again, they show us another somewhere else in the world of how much they're suffering there. And people feel not only guilt, they feel kind of content with what they have, you know, and they've let go of this aspect that, wait a minute, you know, what are we doing here? We can do better. We can do something else. We can do something that would be extraordinary. You know, we can, I mean, really, it might sound kind of cheesy, but we can reach for the stars. You know, we can do other things. We don't have to be stuck with this nonsense of all the bullshit that's occurring right now in this world. I'm so sick and fed up with it, you know? So
yeah,
absolutely. Cool. You're right. I think one thing we have to our advantage to that extent is that the more they push for all this nonsense, the more standoffish normal, regular people will get, and they will begin to look elsewhere. And I think that's something we can, you know, look at as a way of hope in that regard. But you know, Anthony, we could certainly go on here for, you know, another few hours, really. But I think we should we can pick this up another time and continue our conversation and talk more about the things we didn't get a chance to get to this time. There's certainly no lack of topics and all that. But I want to thank you, obviously, for the very interesting discussion, and we really appreciate your time today and talking with us today about your work. But please give us your details again, how people can, you know, follow your writing, and then if there's anything else you'd like to leave us with here.
Okay, well, my website again is realcurrencies.wordpress.com and the Gelg is at Gelg.org. And I want to thank you very much, Henrik, for having me on the show and, you know, having this, I think, very high level chat here with you. And we've been covering a lot of issues, and would be great to maybe look into some issues in a more depth at a later stage. But I think it was a good introduction into what usury is all about and how destructive it is and how at the core of our dilemma it really is. So I'm really happy to have been able to bring it out here.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Yeah, let's definitely pick this up another time. And of course, in the meantime, then we relay people further to realcurrencies.wordpress.com for much more. Thank you so much, Anthony.
And you.
And that is our program for today. We have much more ahead with Mike King, Kerry Bolton, Laird Scranton, and Robert Ferguson, to name a few. Also in the pipeline, program 2 with John Lash, the follow-up to the last one that we did with him. As promised, it's going to be another good one, so stay tuned to redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com for much more. Well, thank you for being a member, and my thanks to the team as well. We'll be back in just a few days again here. In the meantime, stay warm. I hope you have a good weekend, and that you take care of yourself, your family, and your folks.